Chapter 6. While much has been written about Dorothy Kilgallen through the years since her mysterious death, to the extent of exaggeration and untruth, Brenda DeJordan, the daughter of Kilgallen's longtime butler, James Clement, can speak from experience as a primary source. This is possible since the African-American Clement family, James, his wife Evelyn, Brenda, and brother Larry, lived in an apartment on the first floor of the Kilgallen townhouse for many years. The kitchen was on the second floor. DeJordan, a daycare center owner with a pleasant smile who loves children, recalled during two extensive interviews with this author in mid-2017. And on the ground floor was my mother and father's apartment. Doors faced the back of the elevator. We had two bedrooms, bath, and living room. Her parents began working for Kilgallen, DeJordan said, around 1954. My father and mother worked for another couple, and Dorothy knew the family. She went there for a dinner party and met my parents. Dorothy talked to my father. Dad was very outgoing, and Dorothy kind of maneuvered my parents to her townhouse. My father was the chauffeur and took them around in a big black Cadillac. My dad and mom ran the townhouse, the staff, did the cooking, the catering, DeJordan mentioned. They dealt with the cleaning people, hired those to handle the parties. They had full run of the townhouse, she added. Larry and I could go anywhere in the townhouse. It was 5 stories. The glass, marble, and brass elevator was in the middle of a huge, white, thick-carpeted foyer, and there was a staircase that led to the second floor, where there was a special guest's dining room. There was Dorothy's dressing room on the third floor and a huge bedroom. On the fourth floor, Hassan, youngest son Kerry's tutor, and Kerry slept there. We could go anywhere, but never Dorothy's office on the fifth floor. There was a liquor room, DeJordan said, and all this lavish alcohol, champagne, all of it, different bottles, smelled good. Friends would go to Europe and bring back gifts for Dorothy and my parents. I saw chocolate-covered grasshoppers, chocolate-covered ants, etc. DeJordan described Dorothy as a very kind woman, a gentle person. She taught her kids to be respectful of other parents, and she was extremely generous. Brenda continued, at one point, Dick had something wrong with his suit, and it needed fixing, and he told my father to take it to the cleaners or a tailor. My father said, I can fix it. And that began a whole new career for him. Dorothy brought all of her close friends to my father. Journalists, entertainment people, all of them. He even did work for the famous designer Mr. Blackwell. Recalling the Kilgallen children, DeJordan said, Kerry was an active little person. He loved my mom and dad. Spent more time with them than with the nanny. Kerry wouldn't behave with the nanny. And so Dorothy wanted him to be with my mother, since he would behave for her. As far as Jill and Dickie went, DeJordan said, Dorothy raised them to be good citizens. Affluent lifestyle didn't affect them. Dickie and my brother Larry used to go out to jazz clubs together. Regarding the relationship between Kilgallen and the Clements, DeJordan said, they were as close to Dorothy as Dorothy's parents were to her. All of the children, Dorothy's and us, were like brothers and sisters. We sat at the dinner table with the other children. We could have gone to the Hamptons on vacation with Dorothy's family. Larry went, and I went to camp. My mother was a wonderful cook, and Dad wouldn't eat anyone else's food but hers, DeJordan recalled. At dinner parties, there were many prominent people. If they got out of line, Dorothy would run them out. Sometimes Dick drank too much, and he got out of course with Dorothy. He was less than a gentleman to her, not abusive. But then my father would talk to Dick, and he listened to my dad. Concerning how Dorothy acted around the Clement family, DeJordan recalled, status didn't make or break her. We watched What's My Line every Sunday. We were too young to think about it being so special to see Dorothy on there. Life was hectic in the Kilgallen townhouse, Brenda said. They had great parties, like out of movies, decorated the house, great food in and out. Dorothy had golden dinner plates, crystal for the parties. Lots of live music. Louis Armstrong was there. Jane Mansfield was in the kitchen where Mom was cooking. Also, Joan Crawford and Betty Davis were there. Once, Dad helped Marilyn Monroe get to her car because she was intoxicated, DeJordan remembered. I remember a party for Jill. She asked me to teach her how to do the twist. Johnny Mathis was there. I was impressed with the celebrities, the way they dressed. Betty Davis was really nice. I remember Tony Curtis was in the house. DeJordan's recollection of Mathis, whose recording sold more than any artist in the 20th century, other than Elvis and Frank Sinatra, coincides with his appearance on What's My Line in 1959, 6 years before Kilgallen died. On the program, she began the questioning with, "Are you a singer in the entertainment world?" To which Mathis, in a gruff voice, answered,
"Yeah."
4 panel questions later, she asked, "Have you ever autographed a pair of my shoes?" Mathis laughed quite loudly as Kilgallen smiled beneath the mask she wore when celebrity guests were on the program. Then she said loudly, while grinning, "Johnny Mathis." According to DeJordan, celebrities like Mathis visited the townhouse quite often. During the holiday season, November, December especially, it was very busy around the house. The Rothschilds, Dean Martin, Jack Lemmon, Bobby Short was there. Sammy Davis Jr. One time my father went to the door and this short black man was there, and my father thought he was a delivery person. Davis was mad and told Dorothy, but she just laughed. There was more prejudice then than now. But I never felt it in the house, DeJordan said. At one party, one of the guests got out of line, a celebrity, a person of substance, and he made racial comments. Dorothy asked him to leave. And I know that Jane Mansfield used drugs and drank alcohol. Once she started taking her clothes off, and Dad was trying to put them back on. DeJordan added, "And one time, my father told Joan Crawford off in the kitchen. Then Dorothy did as well. Joan was very demanding. At one party, I heard Dorothy tell Joan, 'Don't speak to James that way in my house.'" Concerning Kilgallen's demeanor, DeJordan said, "Dorothy didn't have a nasty side. And I remember she had these little fur slippers, little heels, and her lavish outfits and robes. My father would take coffee and juice to Dorothy in the mornings." Regarding Kilgallen's relationship with her parents, DeJordan said, "She didn't listen to them much. If they told her to go one way, she went the other." While Kerry Colmar apparently never wrote about his mother, he did express feelings about the Clements. He recalled, "The staff was comprised of James and Evelyn Clement, a married couple that served as chief cook and butler. To me, they were friends more than servants. Hiding many of my fiendish pranks and missteps from my parents, covering up for me when necessary. They were always on my side. This I knew." With Kilgallen's popularity rising by the day, during the time DeJordan was an eyewitness to the family's daily regimen, the respected reporter's influence increased, and she became more involved in social issues. Before doing so, Kilgallen had reported on such low-level events as a beauty parlor operator's convention at the Pennsylvania Hotel, the showcasing of a new home in Flatbush, and Tammany Hall's grand old man John Voorhees's 102nd birthday. She even interviewed those living on the top floors of the Empire State Building. James Horan, one of her co-workers, described Dorothy. "She was young. She's fresh-looking. She had spent a fortune on clothes because she had the appearance of having just stepped out of the traditional bandbox. No smell of tobacco, just perfume." He added, "There was just something about the way Dorothy handled herself. I had the opinion that she was born for the business. That soft, quiet way of hers hid a steely ambition and a drive, and also a very keen intelligence." That keen intelligence was apparent when Kilgallen took action in July 1950, just 15 years before she would die, when the right-wing journal Counterattack published an anti-communist book, Red Channels, the report of communist influence in radio and television. In her Voice of Broadway column, Kilgallen strongly condemned the blacklist. She wrote the allegations were not predicated on evidence of communist sympathies, but instead rumor and innuendo. Displaying again the moxie she was known for, Kilgallen wrote, alleging Radio Free Europe was not free, but instead influenced by subversive groups, triggering the CIA's interest in her. A subsequent dossier documented Kilgallen's less-than-cooperative attitude when contacted by CIA agents. They were in search of a source for her column entry. She flatly refused to name names. Reporting such hard-edged news caused the elite of the New York City reporting world to take special notice of Kilgallen. The legendary Damon Runyon, obviously mesmerized with Kilgallen's exploits, wrote of her, "She has soft, dark hair and huge, appealing eyes that gaze at you with an expression of infinite innocence buried in their azure depths. She looks so young and helpless that you say to yourself, 'My goodness, I must assist this poor child in her work. I must shield her from the rough edges of life.' Then you turn your watchfulness to the hard-eyed members of the sterner sex, and you are positively shocked when you pick up the journal the next day and discover that the little girl with the eyes of a gazelle has scooped your eyes off." Oh, yes, that Kilgallen girl. During Kilgallen's meteoric rise to true stardom, husband Richard began cheating on her with a bevy of beauties. Some, as noted, he'd hired for his Broadway productions. When Kilgallen learned of his adulterous behavior, she was livid. One of her friends was surprised at Richard's behavior, recalling, "I remember having to duck around corners because they were saying goodbye to each other. It was really very sweet." He'd say, sort of suggestively, "I'll see you around 8, sweetie." As apparent payback, Kilgallen began to seek friendly escorts to accompany her to Broadway openings and Manhattan nightclub frivolities. One man who was often seen with her was What's My Line producer Bob Bach, one of the originators of the program. Meanwhile, daughter Jill was progressing nicely, with one friend calling her ladylike and loving. At the same time, 10-year-old Dickie was enrolled at a private school, where the development of straightforward and manly character was the goal. In 1951, singer Johnny Ray burst onto the national scene with the best-selling songs Cry and The Little White Cloud That Cried. Please, Mr. Sun became another of his hit records. A top music publication lauded his lachrymose, ranting style. This inspired several nicknames, among them Prince of Wales, Nabob of Sob, and the Atomic Ray. Kilgallen mentioned the crooner in her Voice of Broadway column, writing, "A simply awful thing has happened to me. How am I going to say it? Goodness, it's too frightful, really. Steel yourself, girl. Get it off your bodice once and for all. All right, here it is. I've come to just love Johnny Ray's record of Please, Mr. Sun. Now, will anybody ever speak to me again?" Kilgallen decided to check out Ray's performance herself. In April 1952, Ray appeared at the High Society Copacabana along with the famous Copa Girls. The billing also featured ventriloquist Jimmy Nelson, famous for his Nestle chocolate commercials featuring Farfel the dog. On the 10th of that month, a quarrel between Kilgallen and Richard broke out when he made a disparaging remark about Johnny Ray's singing prowess on the couple's WOR radio show. Always keen to report Kilgallen news and views, the Saturday Evening Post noted that the couple almost came to crockery, plates, dishes, cups, throwing, over the episode. Along with Kilgallen, celebrities who flocked to the Copa to see their favorite stars included mobster Frank Costello, allegedly the Copa's true owner through a frontman, Frank Sinatra, who appeared there, and J. Edgar Hoover, the pug-faced, power-hungry FBI director who enjoyed being treated as a celebrity, despite having nothing to do with the entertainment arena. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis first launched their act at the Copa, and the Barry Manilow song Copacabana was named after the trendy nightclub. When Ray performed Walkin' My Baby Back Home, Kilgallen joined the standing-room-only crowd with a standing ovation. In her Voice of Broadway column the next day, she wrote of Ray, "Ensville. He held the town's toughest audience spellbound." Or maybe it was paralyzed with astonishment. On June 12, 1953, Kilgallen attended Queen Elizabeth's coronation. Wearing a tiara, Kilgallen looked stunning in a silver gown with 10,000 embroidered jewels and pearls encrusted at the scalloped neckline. A white mink cape lined with silver lamé completed an outfit truly fit for a media queen. Kilgallen's coverage of the coronation earned her a Pulitzer Prize nomination. Surprisingly enough, the only one she received during her long and illustrious journalistic career. On a humorous note, Kilgallen reported to her close friends that before the coronation, someone had walked into Elizabeth's dressing room, where they saw the would-be queen dressed in only a daytime frock, writing letters to family members, wearing St. Edward's crown. Kilgallen said, "The crown is very heavy and tiresome to wear." Elizabeth, like any sensible woman with a new pair of shoes, was breaking the crown in. If anyone knew about shoes, it was Kilgallen. At one point, she owned nearly 140 pairs.